This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, welcome to PM. I'm Linda Mottram. Tonight, promising signs the Ebola drug remdesivir could help patients recover from COVID-19, but warnings too that it's no substitute for social distancing. We'll look at new bank data that shows Australians are spending more money gambling online during this crisis. And as millions of Australians download the COVID Safe app, some diabetics are removing it because it's interfering with a life-saving health device.
There are a lot of parents out there who have children with, say, type 1 diabetes on a continuous glucose monitor to rely on that they can dose their children with a life-saving medicine called insulin. So therefore, it's extremely dangerous if the technology you're relying on doesn't work.
But first tonight, the ACT government says the virus that causes COVID-19 has been eliminated in the ACT. A geographically small pocket, yes, but the territory was on a much worse trajectory not that long ago. Several states are consistently recording no new COVID-19 cases for days in a row, but a particular milestone is in the Northern Territory. It's had no new cases for 3 weeks and has become the first jurisdiction in Australia to lay out a comprehensive plan to get life back to relative normality, albeit within borders that are still firmly closed. Let's start in the Northern Territory tonight with our reporter Oliver Gordon.
This is the Territory's roadmap to the new normal.
NT Chief Minister Michael Gunner addressing a socially distanced press pack in Darwin with details on how his government will peel back restrictions.
Because we are the safest place in Australia, we can do this before anywhere else in Australia.
From noon Friday, people in the NT will be able to use public swimming pools, water parks, go fishing with friends and play golf. 2 weeks later, Territorians will head back to the gym, borrow books from the library, get their nails done and start dining in at restaurants and cafes. And by June 5, people will be able to get tattoos, visit nightclubs and even play organised team sports.
Pretty relieved, actually. I think it's coming at perfect timing.
The easing of restrictions is welcome news for Alice Springs cafe owner Ange Badgerick, who has had to make major adaptations to her business to survive through the lockdown.
I think if anything, it's going to bring the energy up in the town. You know, that vibrancy of having people sitting al fresco style outside of a business is just priceless. With everything shut down and people eating in their cars, which I've seen so often, it's just, I think we're going to start to appreciate outdoor seating a whole lot more.
But not everyone in the Territory is breathing a sigh of relief. Central Land Council CEO Joe Martin-Jard says the majority of his constituents won't see a great deal of change to their lives.
It's good for the town of Alice Springs and Tennant Creek, but it really doesn't mean a lot for people living in remote areas.
Strict biosecurity laws governing the movement of people in and out of remote communities will govern most remote communities in the NT until June 18. These harsh restrictions were fought for by the Central Land Council and others as the threat of COVID-19 first became apparent. But now Central Land Council CEO Joe Martin-Jard has raised the idea of easing these, should the health advice permit.
We'd like to see if it's safe to do so, to have those restrictions lifted.
The Northern Territory is very close to being totally rid of the virus, with 25 of its 28 cases now fully recovered. But today, ACT Health Minister Rachel Stephen-Smith announced that jurisdiction had become the first in Australia to eliminate all known cases of COVID-19.
So thank you, everyone, but also keep up the hard work. In particular, if you have symptoms of COVID-19, please take the opportunity to go and get tested for COVID-19.
Across the country, restrictions are starting to ease, but there is variation. In New South Wales, gathering restrictions will ease from tomorrow, and students will return to classrooms by mid-term following a staged return. In WA, a state of emergency has been extended to May 13, but Premier Mark McGowan has announced a cautious relaxation of some COVID-19 restrictions in the state, including allowing indoor and outdoor non-work gatherings of up to 10 people. In Victoria, where a new cluster of cases was identified today at a Melbourne aged care home, restrictions will be reassessed when a state of emergency ends on May 11. Victoria's Premier Daniel Andrews says 100,000 people will be tested for COVID-19 over 2 weeks before a decision is taken on easing Stage 3 restrictions.
With that data, with those test results, we will have options to ease some of the restrictions that I know are frustrating and challenging and difficult.
South Australia has gone over a week without recording a new case of coronavirus, and authorities have started easing travel restrictions within some parts of the state. And from Saturday, Queenslanders will be able to leave their homes for recreation, and the distance they can travel has been extended to 50 kilometres. With a string of recent cases, Tasmania won't follow the lead of other jurisdictions in easing social restrictions.
Oliver Gordon reporting. Well, the Ruby Princess cruise ship that haunted Australia's eastern seaboard for weeks has been pinpointed as the likely source of a serious COVID-19 outbreak at hospitals in the Tasmanian city of Burnie. But a report by the state's public health department that's out today fails to explain how the coronavirus spread from infected cruise ship passengers to more than 80 health workers. And questions about one of the worst outbreaks in the country being left unanswered means that doctors and nurses in Burnie are feeling unsafe as they return to work. Felicity Ogilvie reports from Hobart.
Coronavirus has killed 11 people in northwest Tasmania, and there are still more than 60 active cases in the region. The outbreak has Burnie obstetrician Kim Dobromilski worried. She's asking for extra protection and wants to wear a P2 mask when she delivers babies.
I think the safest option for doctors and nurses and midwives caring for patients, if it's not clear that the patient is safe, then they should be treated as a possible COVID patient. And that same should apply to the staff.
She has the backing of the president of the Tasmanian branch of the AMA, Professor John Burgess.
So our obstetric colleagues have reported that during labour, the level of potential aerosolisation and droplet spread is high, and we would certainly support them in their request that they have access to appropriately fitted N95 masks for their protection.
The Tasmanian Health Minister, Sarah Courtney, hasn't made it clear if the maternity staff will get P2 masks.
Across both our public sites, but also the provisions that are purchased through the Northwest Private Hospital, we'll work with them and with work with our staff and work with local leadership to ensure that the appropriate PPE is there and that appropriate training is provided as well.
Not satisfied, the AMA has itself sent 900 P2 masks to specialist doctors and GPs in Burnie. Also heightening concerns, an interim state government report into the outbreak in the hospitals in Burnie released today. It found that staff caught the virus from Ruby Princess patients in March and spread it to their colleagues and other patients. The Tasmanian Premier, Peter Gutwin, says patients and staff are not to blame.
The name, the Ruby Princess, is known to, I think everybody in this country now. What we know is that about 1 in 10 coronavirus cases throughout Australia could be linked to that ship. Hundreds of cases across many states have stemmed from it. What the report confirms is that most likely that ground zero for the outbreak at the Northwest Regional Hospital was the Ruby Princess.
But the details of exactly how the virus was transferred from known COVID patients to staff and other patients hasn't been revealed. The Director of Public Health, Mark Veitch, says that's because it's an epidemiological report.
It's a document that is based on information collected from cases, usually on the day that they were diagnosed. It's rarely possible in each case to identify a precise moment when infection transmitted from another person to them.
The Tasmanian Premier has dismissed calls from the Labor opposition for a royal commission, saying plans for an independent inquiry are already in place. The AMA's John Burgess argues today's report is not adequate.
It really doesn't do justice to the detailed analysis that's required. It doesn't describe how the virus made its way into the community and into that hospital system.
Whether it's an independent inquiry or whether it's a royal commission, I think what needs to occur is a much broader lens applied to look at the entire pandemic response.
That's the Tasmanian Secretary of the Nursing and Midwifery Federation, Emily Shepherd. Meanwhile, the Secretary of the State's Health Department, Catherine Morgan-Wicks, has promised more protective equipment and training will be available to staff.
What this report underlines is that everyone needs to be aware of their own health and be alert for even the mildest symptom and to isolate themselves from the workplace and get tested.
As part of the strict back-to-work conditions in Burnie, workers are being tested for COVID-19 and they also have to have their temperature taken when arriving at the hospital for work.
Felicity Ogilvie with that report. Well, it seems interest in buying the remains of the collapsed airline Virgin Australia is growing. 20 so-called interested parties are now understood to be serious about taking on the challenge of rebuilding Virgin. It's emerged today from a creditors' meeting. And that's offering a faint ray of hope for the 12,000 businesses and contractors who are owed money, not to mention Virgin's 10,000 direct employees. So to our political reporter Tom Iggledon in Canberra, who's following this. Tom, last week administrators said there were 10 interested parties. Now it's doubled. What's changed?
Well, Linda, it seems nothing focuses the mind like a short deadline. And the administrator, Vaughan Strawbridge, today said that he wanted all offers in just 2 weeks. That's the middle of May. That seems to have scared out a few more interested parties when it comes to the potential sale of Virgin Australia. And he's also pushed out the second creditors meeting. Today was, of course, the first, out to August, to give administrators a bit of extra time to assess those potential proposals. Now, 8 of those 20, he says, have been given access to what he's calling the data room of Virgin Australia's operations. That presumably will give them a deeper insight into what went wrong with the airline and what potentially could go right. Mystery surrounds, of course, to use that phrase, the identity of all 20 interested parties at this stage. Though, interestingly, Nine Newspapers reports today, Linda, that Andrew Twiggy Forrest is among those 20s and he is interested in buying Virgin Australia. He's, of course, close to China. He has a lot of business operations there already through his mining interests. And, of course, 2 of the shareholders existing at the moment in Virgin, or did so before it went into administration, mainland Chinese companies. Now, the former foreign minister, Julie Bishop, was asked about this speculation today when she appeared on the ABC News Channel. Here's a little of what she had to say.
Well, I'm sure that Virgin would be very keen to have an Australian interest, an Australian entity seek to purchase Virgin. I'd not heard that that was a proposition on the table, but I'm sure that they'll look at any offers with a great deal of interest, because what we need in this country is a second viable airline.
Former Foreign Minister Julie Bishop on the ABC News Channel this afternoon. Now, as Julie Bishop says, there's a lot riding on this, Tom, but not just for airline passengers.
Well, indeed, Lyndon, as you mentioned there, Virgin does have 12,000 creditors. They're owed about $7 billion. And that's, of course, speaking nothing of the 10,000 direct employees looking, of course, at joining the dole queue if this all falls over.
Yeah. And more broadly, Tom, there's been some evidence given in Canberra today about the wider unemployment problem sparked by the pandemic response. What sort of numbers are we hearing?
Well, some government officials today appeared at a Senate inquiry into the handling of the coronavirus issue. So when this whole crisis started, there were about 800,000 people who were receiving unemployment benefits. That has jumped now to some 1.2 million, a jump of some 60%. Now, staggering numbers, of course, but also important to note, Linda, that this is in line with expectations. In fact, Treasury expects that number to grow to something like 1.7 million by September, in line with its forecast of around a 10% unemployment rate. That would, in fact, be pretty good news. Extraordinary to speak of it in those terms just a few months ago. Of course, double-digit unemployment would have been unthinkable and catastrophic news. But if it is contained to those levels, and it does appear from these numbers that we're on track to do that, that would be relatively good news, Linda.
Okay. Thanks very much, Tom Iggledon, our reporter in Canberra. You're listening to PM. We're on the radio, on the ABC Listen app, and we are a podcast. I'm Linda Mottram. On Twitter, I'm at Linda Mottram. Now, the pandemic means we're using and throwing away more and more plastic. So why are recycling companies lamenting a shortage of the stuff? Plastic ahead, but a flurry of excitement today about a drug that appears to have slightly improved recovery times in a trial group of COVID-19 patients in the United States. The top US infectious diseases official, Dr. Anthony Fauci, explained to journalists at the White House why the outcome was important.
The data shows that remdesivir has a clear-cut, significant positive effect in diminishing the time to recovery. This is really quite important. It is a very important proof of concept, because what it is proven is that a drug can block this virus. This is very optimistic.
So remdesivir, that's the drug, and the US trial involved 1,603 patients. It was found to reduce the number of days patients had the infection from 15 to 11. But Dr. Anthony Fauci was clear it's not a silver bullet. The trial is also yet to be peer-reviewed, and researchers are also concerned that talk of possible drug treatments will stop people from wanting to practice social distancing. Well, Dr. Gaetan Burgio is a geneticist and infections researcher at the John Curtin School of Medical Research at the Australian National University.
This is, to my knowledge, the first treatment showing efficacy, even modest, against COVID-19.
And what exactly is the drug targeting in these patients?
So the drug doesn't directly act on the virus, but it acts on what the virus needs to survive.
And of those who had improved recovery times in this US trial, do we know whether they may have been faster than average in recovery anyway? In other words, can we be certain that they recovered faster because of remdesivir?
This is unclear yet. We don't know much, and it would be really important to receive more information about this trial.
And a study from China of the same drug has shown no effect, although it was an incomplete study. How should we view that outcome?
So this is a very interesting one. The reason is the trial in China was performed on a small number of patients. For example, in the US, the trial was performed on 1,000 patients versus 200 in China. So it makes a massive difference in possible outcome.
Now, this drug was originally created to treat Ebola. Is there a risk that the drug is being promoted by the drug company that owns it because it's now a drug without a disease to treat? They're promoting their own drug, in other words. Is that a risk?
Yes. So this is a problem we are facing in a way. The company have performed series of trials without control, for example, and the pharmaceutical companies has played quite a lot with it. And it's very difficult to really get if the treatment has some real efficacy against COVID-19.
And this is a repurposed drug. A lot of the drugs that are being looked at are, all of them, I think, are repurposed drugs. How many of them could actually prove to be dangerous to patients?
Oh, this is an absolutely crucial point. The problem is, I believe, quite a lot of drugs could prove to be toxic for COVID patients.
So it's obviously all very tentative and even speculative in many cases still, this idea of finding a treatment for COVID-19. How optimistic would you be that we will find something soon?
I wouldn't expect to find the treatment that would be a game changer. I don't think we would expect for this. So that's why my really an important point is, more than ever, preventive measures like social distancing are way more important than finding the new drug. And we've seen in Australia, compared to other countries, we have done a fantastic job in containing the infection. And I think that's way more important than trying to find a new drug that would be a game changer.
Dr. Gaetan Burgio, thank you very much for your time today.
My pleasure.
Dr. Gaetan Burgio is a geneticist and infections researcher at the Australian National University. Well, the government and health authorities have hailed the public take-up of the coronavirus tracing app, but one section of the community is already uninstalling it. Some with type 1 diabetes who rely on Bluetooth technology for monitoring their glucose levels have reported major disruptions after downloading the COVID-Safe app. Gavin Coote reports.
There's plenty of enthusiasm for the COVID-Safe contact tracing app, with the number of users now in the millions. Melbourne mother of four, Jennifer Ball, was one of them, but she's already uninstalled it.
Having two children with immunocompromised issues, extremely hard not being able to access what I need to and also be able to have this app just in case something does happen with me or my children.
Her 12-year-old son has type 1 diabetes and relies on a device known as a continuous glucose monitor. This prevents Jennifer Ball from having to give him a finger prick every couple of hours to measure his blood glucose levels. But it's not interacting well with the new COVID Safe app on her phone.
It's accessing my Bluetooth. That's when all the problems started. I would press on the app to get into my son's sugar levels, and they would just stop working. It wouldn't let me get past the home screen, and then it would come up with a message that something was interfering with it, and it wouldn't let me get past. So I uninstalled the app just to see if that was the problem, and yeah, everything went back to normal.
Others are reporting similar issues. Denise Ferry-Peterson is a Perth woman with diabetes and an advocate.
There are a lot of parents out there who have children with, say, type 1 diabetes on a continuous glucose monitor to rely on the fact that they can dose their children with a life-saving medicine called insulin. So therefore, it's extremely dangerous if the technology you're relying on doesn't work.
PM understands about 30 to 50,000 Australians with type 1 diabetes use continuous glucose monitors. The national body Diabetes Australia has advised the Federal Health Department that there may be an issue, and it's told people who are worried to temporarily uninstall the COVID Safe app from their phone. Rhiannon Poole is an Adelaide mother who sees the benefit in being able to track her and her 16-year-old daughter's movements during a pandemic.
Because she has two autoimmune diseases, it could be quite dangerous. So I was considering it, yes.
But because she too uses a continuous glucose monitor for a daughter, she'd prefer not to take the risk after hearing from friends about the connectivity issues.
My daughter, because of her anxiety, hasn't gone outside for 2 weeks anyway, so it's not a big deal for me.
Some are cautious about whether this is a systemic or widespread issue with COVID Safe. Alex Zaharov-Reut is a tech commentator who thinks it might relate to certain phone operating systems.
Yeah, look, I doubt it's the app itself because the app is only doing an encrypted handshake with other devices that have the particular app installed. People have multiple Bluetooth devices connected at the same time, and people aren't generally reporting any problems with those. It's not a widespread thing that you hear about.
Tech commentator Alex Zaharov-Reut with Gavin Coote, and we have contacted the Federal Department of Health for a response. Well, we've been wondering what a pandemic does for our plastic use and for the recycling of that plastic. The experts say we are putting more waste in our recycling bins, substantially more, presumably because so many people are at home now. But while that grows, the amount of more useful, higher quality waste that usually flows out of the business sector has shrunk along with the economy. But insiders say the industry in Australia is now much better equipped to handle all this plastic than when China stopped taking our waste 2 years ago. David Sparks has been wading through it all.
Since the pandemic forced us to spend a lot more time at home, we've been throwing a lot more waste into our recycling bins.
People are spending a lot more time at home as opposed to going to pubs and restaurants, so there's more glass being consumed at home in the way of bottles. And there's an increase of paper and cardboard from people eating takeaway.
Graham Knowles is General Manager of IQ Renew, which runs major facilities in Sydney and on the New South Wales Central Coast, receiving and sorting household recycling. They usually receive about a million willy bins worth of recyclable waste every fortnight, but he says that's increased by 20 to 25% since the virus struck.
Well, since the pandemic began, we've put on additional shifts. I can only speak for our facility, but you know, we're now operating 24/7.
Graham Knowles says they've been able to negotiate with their customers and move on all their sorted material. But he says the situation is far from perfect.
The amount of plastic that we're dealing with at the moment is problematic. There are solutions available. We just need to get to a point here in Australia where we can start adopting some of the new technologies that are available to deal with what we call end-of-life plastic. The plastic that can't be recycled, because not all plastic can be recycled.
In the case of IQ Renew, the company has a pilot plant that converts low-quality soft plastics into crude oil. And Mr. Knowles says that's an example of the technology that needs more support as Australia grapples with recycling. Pete Schmiegel is from the Australian Council of Recycling. He says across the board, his members have seen an increase of at least 10%.
The issue is that a lot of the material that's being placed in the recycling bins does not belong there. It's either waste material or a contaminant to the recycling process.
And there's another problem facing our plastic recyclers caused by the economic downturn.
In terms of the business sector, which for our industry is a very valuable sector and from which we extract a lot of high quality material because it's well segregated and sorted out, there's almost a 20% and even more decline in the material coming from that. So our revenue streams are very different. Often we use the commercial and industrial recycling to make our overall recycling businesses sustainable. And without that business element, times are a little bit tough.
The good news is that Australia has made progress since China stopped taking our recyclable waste in 2018. Stephen Shearer runs Plastic Recycling Australia, which has a facility in Adelaide. He says COVID-19 hasn't caused an increase in the amount of plastic he's receiving, mainly because his facility doesn't handle soft plastics. But he has seen an increase in supply over the past 2 years, caused by an improvement in how the industry operates.
What's happened now is that the councils are now paying properly for curbside collections, and the products entering the market at a reasonable cost for us to process.
For all the bad news, it seems like you're saying we've actually improved a hell of a lot.
What's happened is that we've had a couple of years and some reasonable investments. I know that we've invested $25 million. I know another company in Melbourne has a similar size investment. And what's happened is that we've honed our skills over a period of time to develop ways of doing what wasn't possible before. It wasn't possible before to sort mixed plastic. It is now.
Stephen Shearer runs Plastic Recycling Australia. That report by David Sparks. Well, new evidence today that gambling is surging in these times of crisis and isolation for so many. And the evidence is from bank data, because every time you place a bet and pay some money, your bank records the transaction. And what it's showing is that gambling activities increased 5% during the middle of the month, while everything else in growth terms went backwards. Business reporter David Taylor has more.
Ready to go, stalls are back, and they're racing.
Australians are known for their love of a punt.
Beginning well towards the inside fence and master.
But economists warn a recent surge in gambling spending reflects poorly on how many Australians are feeling right now.
I think a lot of people are basically fairly depressed at home.
That's Alan Oster. The vast majority of Australians have been holed up at home over the past month or so, and the National Australia Bank's customer data shows what little money many have left is going into online gambling, including the pokies.
You know, the two top areas in terms of our data, i.e. money that was actually spent rather than a survey, online gambling and internet, and basically things like Netflix and that sort of stuff. So I think people are working from home, and in that depressed environment, unfortunately, gambling always goes up when the economy goes bad.
There have been some steep falls in spending. Transport was down 21% in the middle week of April, while accommodation and food services dropped 19%. Spending on gambling, though, rose 5%.
It is indeed a very depressing statistic.
That's Independent MP Andrew Wilkie. He says these figures are especially disappointing, given his recent efforts to prevent a huge surge in online betting ahead of the lockdown.
Weeks ago now, I wrote to the government and said, can we put a ban on online gambling advertising during the pandemic? The government didn't respond to that. But before that, already there were any number of ways that online gambling could have been made safer by governments, and it hasn't been made safer.
Andrew Wilkie, with any kind of business transaction, often there's a winner and a loser. Gambling is known very infamously for leaving the customer or the user worse off. Who's benefiting from this increase in gambling?
There are very few online gambling companies. So when we talk about online gambling in Australia being a market of, you know, more than $20 billion a year, more than $1 billion being lost every year on online gambling. That's some of that's going in tax to governments, which helps to explain why governments are pretty disinterested in reining it in. But most of it goes to the companies.
What are some immediate solutions that the government should look at in order to rein it in?
For a start, gambling advertising can be regulated much better. So in other words, you know, when your little son or little daughter are getting all comfy and getting sorted, ready to watch the big game, they can be bombarded with gambling advertising. I mean, surely there should be no gambling advertising at any time that children might be watching the TV.
That's Independent Federal MP Andrew Wilkie. David Taylor with that report. And that is PM for today. I'm Linda Mottram. You can find us on the ABC Listen app, wherever you get your podcasts as well. And do subscribe while you're there and leave a review. Talk to you next time.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.
Hi, I'm Stephen Smiley.
And I'm Ange Lavoie-Pierre, and we're from the ABC's daily news podcast, The Signal. We're seeing glimpses of the other side of this now, with 5,500 Australian COVID-19 patients now recovered. But are those people any safer from infection than the rest of us?
Today on The Signal, we're looking into immunity to COVID-19 and finding out what we know already, what we don't know yet, and what it all means for the return to normal life. Look for The Signal on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.